May my words and all our thoughts be acceptable to you, Lord and King. Well, good morning, everyone. And I really must apologise to those of you who are near enough to see that I have a horrible gap in my front teeth. Put it down to an unfortunate accident with a Cadbury's cream egg. So be warned, people. Cadbury's cream eggs can be dangerous. Poor Peter. He certainly seemed to be good at getting the wrong end of the stick. His kind offer to make three dwellings, one for Jesus, one for Elijah, and one for Moses, as told in our gospel reading, is maybe an example of this. Peter's intentions were good. It was an offer kindly meant, but perhaps made without being in full possession of all the facts. I am guessing, although I too may be grasping at the wrong end of the stick, since I'm certainly not in possession of all the relevant information, that you, like me, have from time to time got things a little confused, if not downright wrong. I hate to think how many times I have gone charging in and have ended up saying or doing the wrong thing, because I wasn't in possession of all the facts. Generally, people are very good about this, knowing that the intention was good, even if the actual practice was rather inept. But occasionally, the consequences have been a little more severe. The old adage, look before you leap, has a lot to be said for it. However, as is often the case in life, there is a flip side to this coin too. If we spend too much time looking, the moment may pass and the action may never happen. Perhaps, like so many things in life, it is a question of moderation. A little, but not too much, time given to weighing up the pros and cons before a plan of action is decided on. However, returning to the gospel reading, I must admit that I'm always slightly intrigued by the fact that neither John nor James is recorded as making any comment, and that Peter received no reply to his suggestion. Instead, they are overshadowed by a cloud, and fear overtakes them. We are told that when the voice had spoken, and Jesus is once more on his own with them, they kept silent and told no one of what they had seen. Peter must have been really gobsmacked by what he had heard and seen, because I can't help feeling that silence was probably not his normal state. But let's think a little more about what they have to say about that amazing moment up on the mountain. Luke's account provides us with a clear rendition of what actually happened. He gives us details of what happened when Jesus prayed. His three companions must have been flabbergasted by what they saw, that Jesus' garments had changed to dazzling white. Probably not a very common colour for clothes at that time, and that the appearance of his face had changed, although Luke doesn't say how. But then it got even stranger. Moses and Elijah turned up, and they were obviously immediately identifiable to the onlookers. I can only guess they carried some kind of symbols that identified them. Name badges wouldn't have worked, as the disciples might have been able to read, but they probably weren't the most literate of men. Luke was far more interested in the fact that they appeared in glory. He doesn't explain what he means by this, and that they were talking to Jesus about his departure, which would take place shortly in Jerusalem. It's not really surprising that Peter was confused by what he saw and by what was going on. And in true Peter fashion, he blurted out his comment about building shelters. Luke does explain that the three disciples were very tired, but he emphasizes that they did see Jesus' glory and that they did see the two men standing with him. He also talks of their fear when the cloud engulfed them, and that from that cloud came a voice that said, "This is my son, my chosen, listen to him. The cloud must have left then, and Jesus was seen alone. And Luke completes his account by emphasizing that the disciples told no one of what they had seen. Considering what a blabbermouth Peter had a tendency to be, the event must have truly left them dumbstruck. I think we can probably all follow Luke's account. Like a good historian, he is clear and to the point, but he doesn't seek to explain on this occasion, merely to report. Like me, you may be wondering what exactly Moses and Elijah were doing on that mountain in glory. Why them? Why not some other big names from the Old Testament? Plenty to choose from, after all. Okay, let's start with Moses. In the Old Testament reading for today, Exodus 34, 29 to end, we would have heard about Moses, how Moses looked when he came down from Mount Sinai, carrying the two stones on which the Ten Commandments were inscribed. Although he didn't know it, when he came down the mountain, Moses' face shone because he had been talking to God. This radiance so frightened the Israelites that Moses covered his face with a veil, only removing it when he went back to speak to God again. So Moses had experienced God's glory and bore the marks of it upon him. In the epistle today, Paul spoke of Moses and his veil. To Paul, the veil was not only physical, but also mental. He says that only when someone turns to the Lord is the veil removed from their mind. Because in verse 18, he says that the Lord is in the Spirit, is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. He goes on to say that all of us, with unveiled faces, see the glory of the Lord, as though reflected in a mirror. And so we are being transformed into this same image, bit by bit, because of the work of the Spirit whom Jesus left us as a paraclete. Based on this reading, it would be very easy to think that Paul didn't think much of Moses, but I think it's probably more a case of him comparing the way things were in the time of Moses, that is, the time of the law, and the way things should now be since we have been saved by Jesus in glory and we have been left the Spirit to help us. Those who still cling to the law will not be able to see clearly the glory of the Lord. To Paul, Moses represents the law. Both Jesus and Paul often use the device, if X was blessed then how much more now? Paul isn't looking down on Moses, but up at him, recognizing that what God is doing now is so much more and so much less deserved. Elijah is there for another reason. He was the greatest of all the prophets. He too experienced the glory of the Lord. God sent fire to consume the burnt offering that Elijah had prepared when he stood up against the prophets of Baal, who failed to see their offering consumed in the first book of Kings, chapter 18. In the next chapter of that same book, Elijah meets with the Lord. He meets with him in the sheer silence, and he wraps his face in his cloak so that he will not see the Lord. Together, Moses and Elijah could be said to represent the law and the prophets. By appearing with them at the time of the transfiguration, Jesus puts an end to any idea that he was a second coming of Elijah, which many people had thought that maybe he was. Before the transfiguration, Jesus had asked his disciples who people thought he was. And Matthew 16, verses 14 and 15 tells us, "And they said, some say John the Baptist, but others Elijah, still others Jeremiah or one of the prophets. And he said to them, but who do you say that I am?" Peter already knew in his heart that Jesus was the Messiah, the Son of the living God. So seeing the transfigured Jesus with Moses and Elijah made it crystal clear that Jesus was not a second coming of either of these Old Testament characters. In his epistle, Paul makes it clear that the ways of the Old Testament in terms of the law, the Old Covenant, have been swept away by the New Covenant of Christ. There is no need to hide from God's glory. Jesus has paid the price for us all on the cross. Once God has spoken from the cloud at the Transfiguration, "This is my Son, my chosen, listen to him," there is only Jesus. Moses and Elijah have gone. Perhaps we, unlike Peter, James and John, need to speak out instead of keeping silent, to share the reason for our hope. The fact that Jesus has paid the price once and for all, and that we have been adopted as sons and daughters of the living God. If this is the basis of our hope, we have a duty not just to speak out, but to shout out. My hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. Is this the basis for your hope?